This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the Economist Quality of Death Index for 2015, that's a comprehensive rating of how countries treat their terminally ill, the U.S. ranked 9th out of 80 countries. Not awful, but not great either. While the country has made some great strides in improving palliative and hospice care, one demographic is going largely ignored: kids. Eleanor Cummins is a journalist who focuses on science, and she recently wrote about the specialized considerations required for good pediatric palliative care. The article, called "American Children Deserve a Better Death," appeared in Slate. And Eleanor, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So this is obviously not a subject that any parent or society wants to face. But what is it that makes hospice or palliative care for children different than for the elderly or even other adults?
Children have much more complicated illnesses than adults. So where you can kind of graph or chart the way an adult's illness might progress and provide standard care along the way, a child that is ill is likely going to get better and worse and then worse and then better and then worse again in a kind of really unpredictable pattern. So it makes it really hard to intervene and provide the right care along the way. And it makes it more intensive. Additionally, there are special concerns when it comes to medicating a child. They have much smaller bodies and are also much more sensitive to drugs. So a physician who's prescribing medication for a terminally ill child needs to know the specifics of pediatric dosing. And then there's also the emotional part. A child who is dying is going through a really specific set of kind of feelings and emotions, and so are their parents and siblings. I've spoken with a lot of nurses who have talked about how, when a parent dies, it can be really difficult to deal with, but it is something that you expect. Like, as a child, you know that one day your parents will no longer be there. And usually you're in a position where you're able to kind of help them navigate that end of life situation. But when it's your child, that's never something that you really have to deal with. You don't think about how your child could die. And that creates a situation where parents really struggle to cope and to continue to parent the child that's dying, as well as their siblings who are kind of having to watch this really terrible and rather unprecedented event kind of unfold.
I don't think a lot of people even consider hospice or palliative care for kids. How many children do qualify for hospice care?
The numbers on that have been really hard for me to track down. But it's in the thousands in the United States. And the reason that it's difficult to tell is because the numbers kind of depend on whether you're looking at palliative or hospice care. And then because children go in and out of the system, it's difficult to track them all the way through. But there are sizable numbers. One of the groups that I spoke with, for example, is in Southern California, and they are dealing with about 70 pediatric patients who need a variety of care as they are dealing with what's called complex illnesses that are potentially life-limiting.
Where did the 41,000 number come from in your reporting?
So, according to the CDC, 41,000 children and young adults die each year from a variety of illnesses. And so that number is the comprehensive number, right? That's what happens in the U.S. in a year, and it builds in everything. So with 41,000, you're looking at accidents, which unfortunately kill a lot of children. And those aren't ones, right, where you would need to intervene with palliative or hospice care. But then there are also congenital defects, childhood cancers, and other medical issues that that occur in children. And so those are the situation where pediatricians have the opportunity to intervene and to really help families navigate the kind of situation that they find themselves in with a really sick kid who ultimately may never get to grow up. And so that's the kind of subset of that number that we're looking at with the pediatric palliative care population.
Well, knowing when it's time to transition to hospice care is not a clear or easy choice for most adults. Even acknowledging the need for kids' palliative care almost feels fatalistic. I'm wondering how parents and practitioners decide when to, quote, give up treatment for a child.
Definitely. And I've spoken with a lot of providers about how difficult that conversation is to have. to the point that I think they have it in a really different way. I don't think that it is framed as like a, you know, as a giving up kind of conversation. I think that that may be the kind of implied message, but they talk about it in a way of just, you know, how much can like a body take physically and how much can a family take emotionally of just pursuing curative treatment that doesn't work, right? Like pursuing a cure that isn't happening. And so I think they have those kind of conversations along the way. And I think that they also, and this I found to be really beautiful in the course of reporting it, I think that they speak with children a lot about what their needs are. And, you know, I had someone say to me, like, even at 6 years old, right, like a girl who's dying of cancer knows what she wants. And children in these situations are forced to grow up and they learn to articulate their needs. And I think in a lot of situations, you know, they're really able to communicate how pursuing a cure may not be the most important thing for them, that being with family and kind of enjoying the time that they have and the things that they want to do is really important. And it's definitely just a really difficult conversation to tackle. And I think that it leads to people pursuing treatments far longer than you might say the evidence would suggest they're working.
Yeah, it's astounding to think of. How about logistical issues that stand in the way of establishing more specialized end-of-life care for kids? I'm thinking funding, insurance coverage, maybe even religious or philosophical beliefs.
Definitely. I think that you have kind of a two-pronged issue, right? There is absolutely the logistical side of these things. So financially, all medical care is expensive, and end-of-life care is no different. So it's difficult to find ways to kind of support end-of-life care and families in that situation. I mean, I've heard about people who have gone bankrupt, right, trying to care for their sick child, and that's even before the child is facing like an end-of-life situation. That's why a lot of families actually end up on public insurance, even if they had private insurance to begin with. Their private insurance stops covering them while they're fighting these diseases that their children are facing, and so they end up having to turn to public insurance for assistance. And so there's definitely a financial burden that comes in these situations for families. Logistically, too, you see a lot of struggle with providers who do, many of them do go out and pursue these additional qualifications that will allow them to care for the particular needs of sick children, sick and dying children. But to do that, they need to go to, you know, just a handful of schools that provide these programs. One, for example, is Harvard, right? But not every doctor is located in the greater Boston area. So, you know, they need to apply to this program, take a year off from their job, go and live in Boston, pay the money for the program, and then return with those new skills. So it's a lot to ask. And I think that, you know, even before a doctor gets to that stage of figuring out if financially they can commit to it, there is that kind of emotional burden that comes with this particular issue that I think that we all struggle with, doctors included, where it's really hard to say, you know, that a child is going to die. Like, we've been told that children shouldn't die. And that means that we want to fight it. We want to find a cure. And I think that we all kind of have that mentality. So training and paying to learn how to give up in a sense, right? And how to give up gracefully and how to help others give up gracefully is not a thing that I think a lot of people want to pursue.
Eleanor Cummins is with us. She wrote about the logistical and ideological and emotional hurdles of pursuing end-of-life care, palliative or hospice care for children, for Slate. Specialized cancer care for children often is located in cities, not exclusively, but geography is a real issue for people. The best, the most advanced centers are generally in really populated areas. How would that kind of geography or location play a role in end-of-life planning for kids?
Right. So I am from Washington State. So we have the Seattle, like the greater Seattle area, which is highly urbanized. But the rest of the state is actually pretty rural and pretty divided. Like the Cascade Mountains go right down the middle, right? So, you know, it takes hours to get across them into Seattle. And so, you know, children who are in like the Okanagan Highlands, for example, may not have access to specialized pediatricians. So, you know, like they'll see their doctor for their checkups, but they aren't going to have a doctor who is trained in oncology or an expert in congenital disorders. And they're very unlikely to have a doctor who has gone to one of these specialized programs at a university to train in providing end-of-life care to children. So basically, they and their parents kind of have a choice to make where are they going to look to the resources that are close to them, which may not be, you know, substantial, or are they going to make a commitment to going back and forth across the state, potentially relocating to Seattle and living there, you know, with friends, family, short-term rental, the Ronald McDonald House, to try to get care. And that's a decision that a lot of people have to make. Even, you know, if their child eventually isn't one of the, you know, the children who dies and the child does get better and grow up, you know, they've lost tons of time, money, and resources in that process of trying to fight that disease just because of the kind of luck of the draw of location.
Eleanor, the UK came in first in the Economist Quality of Death Index. What is Great Britain doing that puts them on top? And is this with children's palliative and hospice care as well?
Right. So the UK is on top, I think, a lot because of history. They were kind of they had the leaders in palliative care decades ago who were saying that, you know, there was a reason to put resources and time and thinking into how people died. And as a result, they've kind of generated this culture that really supports people in those last years and months of their life. And that, I think, is shown to be true for both adults and for children. In the UK, there's actually a system of palliative care homes for children. So if your child is suffering from one of these very like complex illnesses that may ultimately prove to be life-limiting, you know, they may die as children, there's an ability for you to go into a specialized care home. And these homes are very small. They're intimate. They're usually for, you know, eight families. And so a child and their parents and their siblings can go there and they can get treatment, but also counseling and support. And there's a real value placed on this idea of respite, that you can get kind of a break from pursuing your curative treatments and from the kind of, you know, hectic chaos that comes from being in a hospital and trying to get better. And so there's a lot more support and also kind of open conversation about how this is something that we all ultimately face, and a value placed on making death as easy as possible.
A moving story, and thank you very much for sharing it with us, Eleanor.
Definitely. Thank you for having me, Virginia.
Eleanor Cummins is a journalist who focuses on science, and you could find a link to read her piece for Slate, which is called American Children Deserve a Better Death. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.